Welcome everybody to this nightclub interview where my guest is a second visit by my dear friend Ryan Hurd, who is, as you'll see, and if you remember, a remarkable authority in the world of the nocturnal practices. And so I'll introduce him with the bio, and we're going to just jump right in exploring his latest book, which I just totally loved. So Ryan Hurd is an educator, author, and dream researcher. He is interested in consciousness studies at the intersections of ecology, spirituality, and material culture. His latest work is Lucid Talisman, Forgotten Lore, which is available exclusively at lucidtalisman.com. He is also the co-editor of the influential scholarly collection, Lucid Dreaming, New Perspectives on Consciousness and Sleep, which is a magnificent two-volume set, which I have. And I happen to have one volume right here. I've absolutely devoured this set. Ryan has been featured on NPR, CNN, Coast to Coast, Psychology Today, and many other venues. With a background in both dream research and archaeology, Ryan currently teaches graduate level courses at University for Peace in Costa Rica and National University in California. Ryan is a member of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and abides by their ethical guidelines. His website, dreamstudies.org, has been going strong since 2007 and now includes his own online education center, Dream Studies Academy, currently lives in Philadelphia. So Ryan, nice to see you again, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me back. It's so good to see you too.
Oh, this is great. And I can't wait to jump into this really fun book. And I have to say one thing that I loved about it. It was so precise and so short in the best sense of that. It's like, oh my God, finally I get to read something that's not going to take me a month. And yet it was written so well and had so many jewels in it. It was like, wow, I wish I could read more books like this. So that's what I want to start talking to you a little bit about. But I want to share, before we get going into it, I want to share my own personal experience when you first so generously sent this. So this is one version of the talisman that we're going to be talking about. And so Ryan very generously sent this to me a while back. And so what I did, and I want to share this with you, is I did exactly what I did when I attend really big empowerments, Kala Chakra empowerments or whatnot. And you may or may not know, Ryan, that what happens in the course of these multi-day events is the big Lama, whatever, teacher Rinpoche, at the end of one of the days, will actually give everybody in attendance a little piece of kusha grass, which is like a little piece of straw. And the instruction is to put it underneath your pillow that night and just let's see what happens. And every single time I've done this, it's like, holy moly, Batman, something really happens. I mean, really remarkable dreams and connection to the empowerment. And so when I got this, before I read your book, I said, I'm just going to do with this what I did with my little kusha grass. And so I put it underneath my pillow, and lo and behold, an amazing evening of really rich dreams. And of course, lucid dreams, right? And it was like, I woke up in the morning with this big smile, like, high five, Ryan. This stuff really works. And so let's talk about this, because this is definitely not part and parcel of standard lucid dreaming approaches, and at least not in the literature that I'm aware of, but you're probably more versed than I am. And it's not overtly, especially talismans, in the dream yoga tradition that I'm studying the most. There again, there's some aspects of it, like I was sharing with my story, but it's not as overtly referenced as it is in what you're presenting with this. So talk to us, let's just start from ground zero. Like, where does the word come from? How do you use these things? And I'll plant a bunch of questions in your direction, but I really want to encourage our listeners, like, whoa, this is a really cool, wonderful augmentation addition to our armamentarium, our skill set for bringing about lucidity. And let's fire away.
Thanks. And so I've got my personal one here too, and it's the first generation. And how you know it's the first generation is that the coins are on the same side. Whereas with, you know, if you, like, you look at a modern, like a quarter, the obverse and the inverse are reversed. And so when you flip it over, you see a different side, right? You flip it. And so the second generations have the flip. The first generation doesn't. Anyway, this thing has been my constant companion since 2015, I think, was the first ones that we minted that looked like this. But yeah, so here's the thing about Talisman and the process that, and I think it's delightful, Andrew, that you had such an immediate experience that was positive.
Day one, yeah.
You know, and so what that tells me is that, you know, it's the power of ritual that really undergirds the entire thing. And of course, lucid dreaming induction and lucid dreaming culture is full of rituals. And what the book does is it just makes that conscious. It's like, hey, check this out. We're actually invoking ritual powers here that are something that humans have been doing for a really long time. Let's make that conscious. Let's use that to our advantage and, you know, do it proactively rather than talking, you know, we talk about techniques and we talk about, you know, cognitive, you know, biases, and we talk about all these sort of like psychological terms. But when you physically imbue an object with power or intention, such as a dream journal that you put beside your bedside table, you're enacting a ritual. And so the talisman is just essentially another version of this. It's the opposite of a new idea. It's the old idea. Yeah. And so talisman's a really old word. It comes from an Arabic term. Amulet as well is a very old word. It comes from, I believe, Greek. And there are two different traditions that kind of come together in modern society, but in, you know, over history they had different denotations. But today people tend to use amulet and talisman sort of interchangeably, and I'm comfortable with that. I think that what's less important is like keeping true to that tradition, and more important is let's use these objects for, you know, in ways that are beneficial and that provide us with power. And so the lucid talisman came about because a friend of mine, Lee Adams, who's also a lucid dreaming author out of the Seattle area in Washington State, reached out and said, I'd like to make a dream coin. And Lee owns a business where he produces medals and emblems and other kinds of like specialty coins. And there's a huge subculture, by the way, in this. Golf tournaments, you see that, you know, and not only that, though, the military is a huge producer and consumer of specialty coins. And that's Lee's background as a veteran. So this is the first time that we really decided to do something in this nature. And we made 100 of them, of this sort of first draft, and I didn't sell them. I gave them out to friends, and then we used them ourselves. And for me, just like your experience, Andrew, it was immediate that this was effective for me as a physical object that I essentially am able to focus my intention, make it real, and then essentially carry through with my with desires for remembering dreams or having a specific question that I want to ask to the dream, you know, dream on, you know, dream incubation, that old skill, that ancient skill, and then lucid dreaming, which is a very specialized form of dream incubation, right? Lucid dreaming is essentially incubating a kind of metacognition in the dream, and so it's less content based and more about meta. And so, it was really effective from the start. Friends told me the same thing. They're like, wow, this is really cool. Doesn't work for everybody. And that's also interesting. And so I think there's certain people who are just attracted to that. And I think that, that's the way that it is. Like there's certain folks who understand and love to work with what I call liminal objects, right? Objects that traverse, you know, the waking world and the other world, the unseen.
Yeah, I'm so glad you closed with that, because that's exactly where I wanted to take this. I found that one of the highlight insights in your book. But I also wanted to share what you write in the book around the etymology, the origin of the word, that is connected to the word telos, as in teleology, which really is designed to bring to an end. And so it really,
that's right.
it harnesses that etymologically. And then also, please correct my pronunciation, but the goddess of ritual, the Greek goddess of ritual, Telete or Telit, I'm not sure how you pronounce it,
but either.
It's connected to that. And so I love this kind of stuff, because as a liminal object, and really retrospectively for me, Ryan, just so you know, in my kind of nocturnal curriculum, I used to have, this is my cartography, of course, so the four nocturnal practices, right? Lucid dreaming, dream yoga, sleep yoga, Bardo yoga. But since then, I've retrofitted with the help of Jennifer Dumpere in her languaging, which I really like, liminal dreaming. And boy, has that really enhanced my nocturnal curriculum. And so this whole phenomena of liminality is something, it's completely resonant with Bardo principles, like something bridges between two different worlds. So talk to us more about that, because that to me is so bloody insightful. How does it actually act as a liminal bridge or a liminal object? And then perhaps a little bit more, because this is where we start to, again, part of the liminal principle, transition from the world of materiality, because here we've got this seemingly solid material thing, but yet we're using it to imbue it with spiritual power. So even right there, that's an intimation of the liminal journey, because here's something physical that you're imbuing with spiritual power. Like, how does that work? Why does it work? So pardon my excitement, but I think this topic is just so cool.
Yeah, no, and thanks for bringing up, you know, and dream amulets too, right? And the liminality, the history of dream amulets is fascinating, goes all the way back, you know, you can really look at, it's cross-cultural. There's some really fascinating stories that I dug up of, 18th century amulets that were used to protect from nightmares. And apparently what I would consider today, what we would call today, sleep paralysis nightmares. And so there's this entire rabbinic tradition, in the Jewish culture, but also in other cultures as well, that have seen this liminality. So liminality, right? The movement between worlds, is something that has always interested me. And I first was interested when I worked as an archaeologist, which was my sort of first career out of college. And I became interested in how, in household archaeology, what is you often see is that people divide human activities up into, they call it zones, activity zones. And so, and this is based on material evidence. And so what do you see? You know, you see fire-cracked rock over here. You see pottery shards over here. You see post molds where the house structure used to be. And then there's these blank spots sometimes in the middle, and especially at thresholds, say where the door, you know, enters the world. And there's something sometimes in archaeology about conspicuous absences, right? And so liminality shows up in the archaeological record sometimes as a conspicuous absence. And other times it shows up as peculiar choices. And so, for instance, the traditions in early modern Europe of protecting doorways with particular objects like iron or crosses, you know, the old Irish horseshoe over the door, right? Protecting the threshold. So something that we have done as humans for a very long time is notice boundaries between zones. And we protect those boundaries with spiritual emblematic powers. So, you know, because a doorway in the most basic sense allows us to leave, but it also allows others to permit entry. And that is, it's trouble. It can invite trouble. And so how do you protect your doorway? How do you do that? And so for folks, if you think about pre-modern folks who are suffering from terrors of the night, as David Hufford called the sleep paralysis malady, and other kinds of extraordinary events that happen at the night, and this the spirituality of the night, right? Deities and demigods and ancestors and spirits and angels and all of this sort translates into the household level in protections of liminality. And one of my favorite modern examples of liminality that's kind of hidden in plain sight is the Christmas Eve tradition of leaving cookies for Santa by the chimney. And meanwhile, what we do, or what often Christians do, is they have garlands on their doors and windows and holly, right? And wreaths and red sashes. And so what we do around this very powerful time of the solstice and the quickening is we protect every entrance to the doorway from malevolent forces, except one. Except one, and that's the chimney, where we invite this weird demigod to come down and provide gifts, and we provide an offering. And so we channel the spiritual power of the house into the chimney for this one event. That is all about liminality right there.
And isn't it interesting also that that's a unique door that joins heaven and earth, right? Most of a lot of other doors are horizontal. This is a vertical aperture of opening. So this is so bloody interesting. Yeah. So this immediately, Ryan, begs the question of how does one use an amulet? Obviously, you're intimating that it can be used as protection, which I think is really a fantastic way to engage this type of object. But maybe let's backpedal just a little bit. This stuff is so rich. How does one activate it? You mentioned in your book very beautifully, how does one activate an amulet? And then how does one use it actively? I mean, what outside of what we're intimating here, one would be protection of entrance of forces. And I want to circle back around to that later, because this is a really big topic in terms of like the influence of seemingly external agencies upon our own personal mind space. But that's maybe a few minutes down the road. But maybe with your permission, backpedal a little bit. Like, this comes in the mail. How do I activate it? And then how do I use it actively? What are the multitudinous ways that I can engage with this, both right, nocturnal adventures and my diurnal adventures as well?
Yeah. So the main thing is to have a clear intention of what kind of dream experiences are you wishing to bring into your life. And so that's different for every person. And so it could be, as we talked about, metacognition as a dream incubation. It could be, I'd like more lucid dreams. But some people also are looking for specific, right, answers to questions, or they're looking for meetings with a deceased loved one, or creative solutions to problems. Mathematicians are looking for good equations. Computer programmers are looking for solid code. All the stuff we know, right? We know it comes in dreams. It comes in hypnagogia. And it comes through intentionality and by creating space for it. And so when the product shows up, it's a coin, and you imbue it with your own intentionality by a number of ways. The first thing that I recommend is that people purify it. And so, you know, there's traditional ways of purifying a coin. And this is to get, you know, it depends on your worldview, but if you want to remove like my traces from this, because I'm the one who ships this out, you want to maybe run it over some cold water or put it in some salt, right? These are traditional ways, or perhaps some smudging, you know, some aromatic smoke, right? Cedar, for instance. And you can say a prayer at this time as well to sort of say, this is an object for me to focus my dream energy, however that may be. And so that's it. That's really what an activation is. And an activation, more than anything, is to say, I'm going to use this in a specific way and in no other way. And so what happens with all liminal objects is that things are really exciting at first. And then we get used to them being around because we desacralize them. And then before you know it, it's banging around in the washing machine, right? And so when that happens, that's a sign, I need to put this away, because this is not a time where I'm actually doing active dream incubations, or I'm not using the coin in the way that is helpful. And so I suggest to people to put it away, put it in darkness, put it in your underwear drawer, put it wherever you know, is that special sacred place that no one else can go. That you hold, you know, maybe your bedside table, and bring it out when you want to use it.
Yeah.
And that's just what it's for. And that's how you maintain the power in the relationship of the object.
So this is so great. And so, So let's say a little bit more, Ryan, or let me invite you to say a little bit more. Again, this is where this is one reason I love this particular phenomena altogether, because on one level, oh, this is really nice. This is a really cool looking coin, right? Right. Done deal. Great, great paperweight. Great little.
It's a great paperweight.
It's a great paperweight. But on another level, it's actually quite profound. And the avenues of profundity that I want to start to explore with you a little bit is this whole issue of liminality and the so-called, for lack of a better phrase, the impregnation of seemingly material objects with seemingly external powers. Because this is very interesting, because in many, many traditions, if a particular substance isn't blessed, isn't activated, it just carries, I mean, no kind of covert esoteric powder. And so in my own experience, like if I could take my camera and show you, I have tankas all over the room. I have wonderful rupas, little statues. And every one of these has been empowered by lamas, where they do these quite amazing rituals. And this is the difference between going to a trinket shop in Kathmandu, where you can get anything and go home and put it underneath whatever. Or you get it, and then your lama charges it, and then you take it home and you put it on your shrine. In fact, you're not supposed to do that until it is actually activated in that regard. Mm. So something quite beautiful is taking place here that maybe we can explore. The transition, the liminality between the spiritual and the material. Because it's like, okay, from a purely physicalist, materialistic point of view, okay, like, there's just no way, right? This is a physical world. This is a physical object. How does mind, how does spirit somehow impregnate into so-called matter? And to me, and then I'll pause for air here, is that this then starts to go really deep, because we start to really question the relationship and the difference or not between mind and matter, spirit and matter. And so maybe a little bit from your experience of the phenomenology of the power of blessing, the power of bringing these special, so-called special forces, right? This is great. Better than the Green Beret, right? Special forces into these objects that then like, hey, wait a second, there really is something going on here. So can you talk to us a little bit about your understanding of that?
Yeah. And I think that skepticism is really healthy, because people often say, yeah, but does it work? And the answer is, well, it works if you allow it to work. And so there's no objectivity here. There's only the subjective analysis, which is where all the good stuff of consciousness is anyway, right? And I love this topic when I look at the historic, you know, sort of the long tail of history, because I see that, as you said, in the Buddhist tradition, there's this really rich use and history of how objects are used and carried and passed on and blessed. And in European traditions, we have these as well. But there's some commonalities. And the commonalities are that certain kinds of objects are better as liminal objects than others, right? And so objects made of metal are classic, iron and copper, right? Yeah. They're classically used as liminal objects. They have properties that show up in the other spaces. They present themselves without bidding. And this is how people learn about these properties. Another one would be certain kinds of stone, you know, and all you can get into gemmology, but like obsidian as a liminal object, as a volcanic glass is something that this was one of the aha moments for me, honestly, of how liminal objects work. And before the talisman, I had an experience where obsidian showed up in a dream as a liminal object. And essentially it was a very odd dream where I essentially inserted a piece of obsidian into my eye, almost like I was inserting a cassette into a cassette player or a Nintendo cartridge into an NES. Like it, that, and there was some pain. And then my vision clarified in the dream after I did so. And it was just this intuitive movement that happened. And when I woke up, I was like, wow, that was really odd. why obsidian? And then I realized I was sleeping in my office, and I keep a piece of obsidian in that office space in the corner of the office to sort of absorb energy. And I had set it there when we had moved into that house, probably 8-10 months beforehand, and I had forgotten about it completely. So the obsidian was there the whole time, holding space, and then it emerged into the dream in this new way. And I said, that is liminality. That is an object that transverses the worlds, and it doesn't have to do anything with necessarily my intentionality. There's something else that's present that is beyond, right, my own neurotic intentionality, right? There's something deeper. What is that? And that's what kind of got me started with this level of thinking that I found so exciting. And so I very specifically do not bless the talismans that I ship out to people, because I don't think it's a good boundary for me or for any of the folks that I work with. And so that's why I provide instructions of how to do your own consecrations. But I love this idea of, say, like a special weekend, where then I would like hand the talismans off. Then it has the energy of our time together. It has the energy of relationship. And in everything that was spoken about and felt internally is now represented in that object. And so that's something different. But yeah, there's some French historians who say, yeah, if you ever buy an object with money that you go into an occult shop that's already consecrated, says the shopkeeper, run away, right? That's not what you want to be getting into. So there's some interesting tendrils here that have to do with how do liminal objects hold on to, disperse, and communicate power, intentionality, and even information.
Can you say a little bit more about that, your understanding of that?
Well, I think it's a great mystery to me. And I came with this with a very skeptical mind, honestly. And as I'm one of these people who has a very rational, materialistic, dualistic perspective when I'm awake. And then at night, it all dissolves and leaves me befuddled. And so this is my constant grinding of ego. How does this stuff work? And I've realized I don't fight it anymore. I use it and I work with it because it is effective.
And what I love about this, Ryan, is that when this starts to go really, really deep, because for me, when I play with this, is it really starts to question, challenge, and then overthrow the tyranny of materialistic appearance and duality, right? Because again, from a materialistic, physicalist, a dualistic point of view, I mean, BS, right? There's no way. But if you start to realize, hey, wait a second, there's a liminal object that can actually act in this kind of multivalent way as a bridge between different worldviews, part of the way I play with this is that it really challenges, overthrows my view of what matter is. And that fundamentally, it's not what the high priest of Western materialistic science tell me it is. It's actually a manifestation fundamentally of mind. And so let me just toss this in and see how this lands with you, because in the esoteric Tibetan tradition, when they talk about sacred grounds, pilgrimage places, empowered things like the Great Stupa in Bodh Gaya, I don't think it's disconnected from that type of phenomena, mm-hmm. where what they say in the Tibetan world, again, and this is very a little bit tricky for me, because on one level, I don't want to desacralize this by reducing it to this mechanistic explanation, but I do think certain things can be thrown into the mix that can maybe help us expand our views by bringing some explanatory power to what I'm going to say. And that is that in the Buddhist view, at the level of the eighth ground, the eighth bhumi, which is a really high level of realization, one characteristic of that ground is the mind of that meditation master literally starts to mix with so-called matter. Duality is actually literally breaking down, the kind of dissociation thing is breaking down. And then the internal is starting to infuse the external. And hence, that's why they say if you go to a sacred power spot, you feel it. You walk into the space, a shrine room, a temple, or whatever, and it's like, wow, there's something here. Well, where is that something coming from? Where did it come from? Well, one, again, without shrink-wrapping it, one so-called explanation is the mind of an awakened being literally impregnates, stamps the so-called material patterned reality. And that perfume is then left there for us to then come into that environment and be beneficiaries of that. And so I love this because this to me stretches the whole mind matter thing. And it's like, hey, wait a second. This thing, you know, on one level, this is not made of matter. This is made of frozen light. It's made of heart, mind, spirit. And so through the power of a ritual that even embodies the ritual or imbues the ritual object, you're playing with these really magical phenomena that therefore, I think to me, this is just my riff, tend to like really challenge some foundational views of the way I relate to reality, period. So this is way to the deep end of the pool. We can come back for, you know, like how to use this in life, that kind of thing. But since we watered into this area, when I was reading your book, it was like, whoa. I mean, this, I immediately went to esoteric Pure Land teachings, to sacred geometry, sacred ground, saying this is just a microcosmic iteration of this very profound process that takes place at these more macrocosmic dimensions. So what do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I agree. No. And so bringing in the concept of sacred sites, what makes a site sacred? You know, what is the recognition of one spot over another? And an example that we see in archaeology the world over is the placement of prehistoric rock art, petroglyphs and pictographs. They're not just placed randomly where there happens to be a flat spot. Some places are composed of layers and layers and layers of rock and images and scratchings, and others nearby are left blank, right? We see this in Paleolithic caves from, you know, in France and in Spain, and we see this in in California and in Mexico and in Colorado. Oh, you know, why? Certain spots have more power than others. And it's interesting because they are connected to, but not reduced to, natural features. So streams, springs, cliff sides, boundary zones, again, liminal zones in ecological matrices, you know, and so there is a hidden realm to a boundary zone that exists in the dream world or the other world simultaneously with the material component that we can see, quote unquote, in day with our rational, you know, dissociative dualistic mind. And so when we enter these spaces and can find a way to make space, which is hard, I think, and I use a couple of psychological processes to help me move into a sacred space. And it involves prayer as well as things like, you know, Eugene Gendlin's psychological focusing methods of noticing projections and letting them go. It's, you know, sort of Western analogs to mindfulness to get in touch with our intuitive centers. When we do that, as we enter a sacred space, and we are more likely to pick up on resonances and anomalous sensations, anomalous perceptions. And that is key. The anomaly is key because that's the thing where that's the crack in the wall between worlds often. And it's the thing that's so easy that the rational mind can dismiss and get rid of because it doesn't fit a pattern or a system of belief that we already hold, because we're always trying to break things up into pieces and understand how they work. That's just the way that our minds work in this particular era. And so how do you get back to that space? And you get back to that space by prayer, by community, and by ritual, and by being together. And so, yeah, it's so fascinating. And a story that comes to mind for me about liminality that still shocks and surprises me every time I allow myself to think about it is a time when I was working as a field archaeologist. This was like 20 years ago, and we were surveying the pine woods of Alabama, lower Piedmont, Alabama, for a road that was going to be proposed to come through. And so my job was to go through with a line of folks in basically traverse this proposed roadway and look for archaeological materials in the soil by digging a hole every 30 meters or so and looking for artifacts. And so anyhow, I was very sleep deprived this particular day. I think I had stayed up late the night before. I can't remember the details of that, but I know that I wasn't in my quote unquote like normal rational mind. I was a little bit altered from my sleep deprivation. And I was walking alone, and the next closest person to me was maybe 100 feet up the hill from me. And we were in this mature pine forest when I suddenly had this image that came unbidden of a tombstone, like a classic Western, like almost like Wile E. Coyote, like cartoonish level tombstone. And it was just front and center in my mind's eye. And I said, whoa, it stopped me in my tracks. And so I walked a little bit further. And as I was looking and perceiving, that's when I noticed off of my transect, but off to the side, this slight depression in the ground. And I went to investigate it, and it turned out to be the depression of an unmarked grave. And so the pine needles had created this little kind of boom. And it was just a very slight depression that I would not have noticed had I not been essentially jarred into this interesting state of alertness. It was not even on my transect. In fact, it was off to the side. I called my partner over, and we investigated it, and we found something like 15 or 16 unmarked graves. And it turned out to be an enslaved graveyard from around, late 1800s, mid 1800s or something like that. And I'm happy to say they didn't build a road there because they went around it. And so that was preserved. But the liminality of that story, like something came forward with information, and then my mind interpreted it and provided an image. And the image wasn't accurate in a one-to-one sense, but it was accurate enough that the information made sense to me and came through to me and allowed that to happen.
That's, oh my gosh, there's so much to say here. This, what a great story. One very brief thing here in terms of like natural power spots. I live literally a couple miles, not a couple, a couple dozen miles from the Continental Divide, which is like the spine, right, of the country. And I mean, what an interesting coincidence that starting with the Great Stupa of Dharmakaya all the way down to Santa Fe, Taos, Crestone, there's a whole battery of stupas that some esoteric writers talk about. They act as like spiritual acupuncture points along the spine of the country to help balance and distribute the energy. So I love this kind of really out there stuff. The second thing is, I also love your reference to anomalous experiences, because for me, the anomalous is an intimation of the non-dual. As is synchronicity. Synchronicity is an intimation of the non-dual. The inside is resonating with the outside. That's what makes it synchronous. And my one of the scholars I really appreciate these days, I'm sure you've read Jeffrey Kripal, he talks often about the stranger it is, the truer it is, the more real it is. And so on one level, what this does is this actually, and this is, I think, what we're doing in our conversation, is we're empowering with what we're talking here. Okay, all right, well, why should I use this thing? Well, I think what we're doing here is we're empowering the right view of the depth of the scope of what's involved with this thing that can otherwise be just another little whatever we throw into our skill set. It's like, hey, wait a second, this is non-trivial. And so again, I'll pause here. The other thing that just popped into my mind, it didn't when I was reading your book, was this to me all of a sudden now adds a third to what I call my magic induction techniques. This is my languaging. So for me, the magic induction, number one is devotion. Number two is compassion. And now, hey, for the first time, it's like I have a new magic induction technique, courtesy of Ryan. And so maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, the magician aspect of this, how we can really start to just expand wonderful tool to really add a very profound new dimension of induction technology, for lack of a better term. Anyway.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm not the first person to make a dream coin or a dream liminal object. Like there's many more, and someone made one in the 80s. And I'm not sure if it was Stephen LaBerge, but it was sort of around Stephen LaBerge's Folks, and it's like a game token. I've seen a picture of one before. It's like a game token, and it says, you know, you're dreaming or something like that. And so anyhow, I just wanted to state that, like, this, again, this is not a new idea. A friend of mine made wristbands that have the phrase, "Am I dreaming?" that he handed out once at a lucid dreaming conference. Elliot Gish, he's a PhD researcher. I wore that for a year, and I loved it. I loved it because every time I looked at my hand, I would ask myself, "Am I dreaming?" And so it allowed me to do my, you know, repetitions of reality testing, the critical state theory stuff that Paul Foley came up with, you know, in the 1950s, and that Stephen LaBerge really made popular. And so the coin helps with, in a very practical sense, with these kind of core lucid dreaming tactics. That's the main one being doing the reality test and doing it in a real way, really actively asking, am I dreaming? And then testing, how do I know that I'm not dreaming, right? I think often people forget about that second part. Like, if you don't actually do a test of some kind of confirmation, then you're going to do the same cognitive habit in your dream. And I've had that happen millions of times, probably, where I was like, no, clearly I'm not dreaming. And I just kind of go on my merry way in my dream because of some like erroneous concept. And so what I love about the coin is it's just bizarre enough that it, you know, works as a liminal object, and it uses text, because in text, as you know, in dreams is shifty. And in waking life, it's not. And now I was just talking to Robert Moss not too long ago, and he was like, well, when I look at text and dreams, it's super clear and I can read a paragraph. And so, you know, that's an example of how it doesn't work for everyone. Everyone's kind of a little bit of a different cognitive mindset. But the big language here, when I get back to this concept that you just were drawing back about the magician, right? I think that the language of alchemy is where we're going, right? And so the Western tradition that is non-dual, that moves from this concept that there is psychological processes and that there's material processes, and together creates a third body, right? And there's Jeffrey Kripal again. I love Kripal's work. Yeah. So what is the third body? How does that show up? And the way I treat alchemy in the Lucid Talisman book is very glancing, I would say. It's not particularly deep. If folks want to see a really wonderful treatment of alchemy as it pertains to lucid dreaming, Melinda Powell is the author. She wrote a wonderful book called Lucid Surrender recently that goes deep into alchemical processes. And you should speak to her, Andrew. But the way that I use alchemy in the book is to look at just simple ideas of solar and lunar energies and how lucid dreaming can become that third body, that place where the lunar and the solar comes together. So the solar essentially being our, you know, ordinary sort of rational waking level ego mind, and then the lunar being the intuitive mind of the dream world, and lucid dreaming being a way that we can direct our awareness while we're in a lunar universe, while we're in an intuitive place. And why I think this works is that a lot of, especially beginner lucid dreamers, are really hung up on the solar and just trying to manipulate objects and make things happen and bucket lists and that kind of thing. That's a lot of fun. But it doesn't appreciate the lunar sensibilities of the dream world. Everything that comes, that percolates through, that has to do with intuitions and emotionality and the body, and the way that everything becomes diffuse and time sort of moves in a different fashion, right? The underworld comes through, ancestors come through, and devotional figures come through, larger than life, otherworldly figures that impart wisdom and terror, I should say, right? So sometimes both at once. And so how do we make room for that? And that's by moving into lunar practices of being able to surrender into the dream. and not try to control things all the time with the rational mind.
Yeah, that's, oh my gosh, there's so much here, but just a couple of things, Ryan. One is, you know, the insights are coming just as you're speaking here, that I'm starting to really relate to this now as a kind of more of an actual tantric object, because, I mean, there's just other languaging, you know, alchemy in the West is analogous to tantra in the East. And they both work with these, instead of transforming lead into gold, you transform poison into medicine. But the same underlying principles are there. And so now, to me, even further, I see this as a kind of tantric object for several reasons. One is, in tantra, the female dominates. In fact, in very esoteric tantric rituals, the female actually penetrates the male. And female is related to elements here. And so even when we're going to sleep in classic dream yoga, what do? You lie down on the right side. You close off your right nostril. That invites what I call bad breath, which is the solar male energy that runs through the right channel. It invites the opening of the left, more feminine, receptive energy. In Tibetan Buddhism, you want to sleep, dream, and die in a feminine state because you're returning to this kind of primordial mother matrix of reality. And so to me, this is like, wait a second, this is also, not only is it an alchemical object in this deep regard, but I completely can now see it as a tantric object, where it has this feminine invitational quality, seducing you into, in the best sense, into a more receptive, open quality of mind. And then also, I want to spin back and I want you to say a little bit more about what you just closed on, which is super important. This is a very common critique of dream yoga, which I think is often misunderstood. Oh, these dream yoga people, it's all about controlling your mind, controlling. But what you're saying here, I really want to riff on this a little bit. Yes, on one level, there is something to be said about transforming, controlling aspects of the mind. But it's also this receptivity, this more feminine accommodation space for the play of the mind, that really at the highest levels of dream yoga, my stage 8 and 9, these are the highest stages of dream yoga, where you're done with the transformation, you're done with that kind of even male end of it. And now it's more this kind of receptive, you could, dare we say, feminine relationship to the display of the mind. So say a little bit about that, because dream yoga is often, and to some extent, lucid dreaming is often criticized. It's all about control. Well, it's controls, but in a certain way, you're controlling it with space, right? Just feminine quality.
Yeah. And I would add that it's about, there's sort of a pre-trans fallacy here. A lucid dreamer, when they emerge into the dream, has to create a sense of power to be able to grapple with the intuitive and the unknown. And so it's almost like one needs that primacy of power happens first, perhaps in a self-protective way. And then once a dreamer realizes I'm safe here, I can exist in this realm, I can wake up if I need to. Once those sort of primacy needs are met, then one can dissolve that ego and move into this more spaciousness and the letting come, right, of surrender and letting go of these sort of middle world thoughts and moving into these other spaces. And so I think there's something developmental that's important. I mean, when I was a teen and had nightmares of lucid dreaming, it was very important that the first thing I said to a lucid dream was no, because I was creating a boundary. It's psychic self-defense. And so we have to talk about psychic self-defense as, you know, as a capacity. And so people, I think, misuse that. And in no way is, you know, the use of manipulating of objects that's done within a Western, an Eastern perspective, that's like undergirded by compassion and interconnection with the universe, is that the same as the Western ego trying to extract a piece of information and a manipulation that's done with the idea that none of this is important? Not that it's not real, but nothing that I see is actually important. And so there's sort of this hidden nihilism, I think, in the Western version of the world of this isn't real, which is very different than Eastern sensibilities. And so, yeah, Serenity Young talks about that and some of her work as well, about you can't just like throw back and forth. And so lucid dreaming gets a lot of gets a lot of crap for that. And I blame marketing, honestly, because what happens is that lucid dreamers, as they move into advanced lucid dreaming, they discover this for themselves, or they get scared and they back off. And so what I like to do, what I hope is that this provides people with some protections and some like a roadmap to move forward into where it's safe to open up and go to this third body, to this space where we can interact in a way with the anomalous and the unknown, and see what comes and learn rather than go into the dream to take.
There's so much here. So to what extent when we open ourselves up to these agencies, and again, this starts to challenge and even break down the dualistic boundary borders. To what extent are these agencies, in fact, agentic? To what extent can we relate to them as guides, peeps, external forces, whatever? Because you talk about in your book about harnessing active universal forces through transference. So maybe talk to us a little bit about this really delicate dance between, okay, I'm on one level, I'll see it when I believe it. So there's this internal kind of, placebo isn't the right idea, but there's this mind effect, right? I'm imbuing this with my power, with my mind, and then it has a kind of correlative power based on what I imbue it in, with my belief. If I believe in it, I'll see it. But at the same time, what I also love about this, there is some quote unquote external agency being invited here. There are powers that are not part of our event horizon that are actually invited in. And in fact, on one level you talked about earlier, this can be used to close the door to less than benevolent, some even malevolent forces that can come in. So talk to us a little bit about that. Again, returning to the non-dual thing. And then I also wanted to just catch, you mentioned a couple of things that really could warrant a little bit of fleshing out the developmental issue around this. You talked briefly about pre-trans, Ken Wilber's wonderful exploration of confusing and conflating a transpersonal with a prepersonal phenomena. And also, I think a really important thing that maybe warrants a little bit more fleshing out, the developmental issues that are being suggested or intimated here. So hopefully that's okay. Two big things. One is, just if you got it, the understanding between internal and external so-called agency. Where are these, how much of this are we inviting from the outside, quote unquote? How much of are we actually invoking from deeper dimensions of our, speaking as an archaeologist of consciousness, from the deeper stratified dimensions of our own being? How much of that is actually coming up from within? Or in fact, is it both?
Man, these are such great questions. Well, Robert Wagner does a really wonderful job, I think, of laying out a developmental model for lucid dreaming that I think works for most folks who are raised in a Euro-American, mind frame. In his classic book on Gateway to the Inner, what is it? Gateway to the Inner Soul.
I have it in my bookshelf around the corner.
Yeah. Anyway, his 2009 beautiful, wonderful book. And he speaks about sort of this first. It's all about me, and then
Gateway to the Inner Self. I think, is that what it is?
Yes, that's it. Thank you. Yeah, Gateway to the Inner Self. And so he kind of moves through kind of a 5-stage developmental process that I think is really resonant with what folks move through, with a bias towards an interest in transpersonal information gathering. So Robert, his passion is about speaking to the voice behind the dream, and sort of that abstract way of thinking that can come out of ordinary lucid dreams and sort of move into these sort of more transpersonal realms where we're almost like in the mathematics of the universe. The matrix and voices come through and spiritual downloads come through, and it feels informational. And then there's this other sort of movement that I've noticed, which is more tantric in nature, where lucid dreamers sort of move into a realm of soul that seems to be more connected to emotional intelligence and healing states of consciousness. It's more shamanic than it is meditative in a really I'm just adding dualisms to our conversation here. But both of these ways of knowing are valid, and come through kind of our own temperaments. And so we're not all on the same developmental platform, I would say. I think that there's a destiny, perhaps, to the way that we move into spaces. And I love to ask people, what were your first lucid dreams like? Because sometimes those first lucid dreams show a taste of the trajectory ahead, you know, the first taste kind of experience that you hear about with enlightenment. Can really be seen in lucid dreaming as well. People have this really impactful experience, and then they get into lucid dreaming and there's a deflation that occurs in sort of the middle stages, and people get bored and they run into resistances and things don't work anymore, right? I really love working with people who are in this stage because when they make that turn again, it's just like the floodgates open back up to new experiences in new levels of understanding. But when it comes to agency, I mean, I would say ? I don't have a framework that really that I like when it comes to what comes through and what is this. But I do think that it's important that folks understand their own belief systems as they move into these landscapes. Otherwise, it's going to bite you on your ass. So many times, and this is true for me, you know, the way I think about things in the waking world is very different than in the dreaming world, because my ego is different. I'm not the same person, right? And so nothing is real is true, including myself, right? And we see these different constellations of ego occurring in the dream. What is available to consciousness? What is hidden? What is in shadow? Like, this shifts. Like, we're just like, we're floating around. Jeremy Taylor used to use the notion of the ego being in a blanket, and we're like a sock puppet, you know, and we just like, the ego takes a certain shape and it does a certain thing for a while. And then it comes back down and it shows up in another way. We're a sock puppet. So what is that all about? And I don't know. But I know that I have had a much better time with these experiences once I learned some sort of ground rules for my own boundaries, like what in sort of dream interactions I will tolerate and which ones I decide is enough. And that's difficult, because it's not a hard and fast rule. It's actually felt in the moment. And so it's not about what, it's about feelings and intuition. And so when these self-helpers come, or these larger than life figures, my inclination, and I recommend this for everyone, is to treat them with respect and to assume that they are quote unquote real, because the thought, this isn't real, this is just a dream, is toxic. Yep. It's a toxic thought, and it devalues everything. And maybe it's offensive to the energies coming through. And so I at least grant agency at a bare minimum of a productful interaction in relationship. And this is the cornerstone of, I think, any kind of compassionate worldview.
Well, let me share a story with you around this that was sent to me somewhat recently that really had an amazing impact. Because over the years, and you'll see why it's had such impact. This is worth talking about, because this whole riff is really impactful. I've had many, many dreams, some of the most impactful dreams of my life over the last several decades of really my root teacher, the radical iconoclastic Trungpa Rinpoche, right? The crazy wisdom guy. I've had so many dreams with him. And so a person shared with me a really beautiful intimate story where Rinpoche was with her. And basically during the course of a conversation, and this just floored me, she was talking about, oh, you know, I had this dream of you the other night, blah, blah, blah. And Rinpoche turned to her very directly with a really like very sharp and said, you know, that was me. And she went, yeah, right. Nice. Right. No. Then he turned back and said, no, that was me. And then, you know, same thing, like, thank you for sharing that. Seems like, and then finally, the third time, he turned around with like almost wrathful energy. He goes, no, that was me. And so to me, I don't know, maybe it was just I was ready to really hear that. But it was like, that to me is a definitive as I need to hear of the kind of porosity. You know, the my teacher, Kempo Rinpoche, another major teacher, says one of the things that characterizes the dream arena is the veils are thinner and you're more porous, you're more translucent both to yourself and to the other. And that's where protectors and guardians and that whole thing, maybe we can come back to that, can really come into play. But I've always wondered, because like you, we're so similar during the day, orange, you know, in the Claire Graves developmental schema, rational, logic kind of guy, science kind of guy, you know, that's the way I roll. But then I dance between these two worlds in the dream world. Exactly. In the dream world, it's a totally different game. And that little orange thing goes into teal or whatever. It's a completely different deal. And so I dance between those two worlds. I mean, half these books are science books. The other half are all these kind of mystical out there kind of things. So I wanted to throw this out for our listeners, because to me, that proclamation and what you're saying here, treat these characters with respect, treat them as if they were real. Well, here's the way I relate to them. They are as real or unreal as we are. And in fact, I would say they're almost more real, really, because when you're lucid to it, I think you're more in contact with reality in the lucid dream arena. So I want to just put an exclamation point on that for those people who wonder, oh, you know, the pejorative thing. Oh, it's just a dream. It's just a dream character. And so for Trump Rinpoche to come with such authority, almost wrath, and saying, no, that was me. It just hit me, smacking me in the face, and said, okay, I got it. I finally understand. Thank you. So I wanted to throw that out, because that was a big deal for me to get that story.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for telling that story. It sounds like a aha moment of the big kind. Yeah, I I've had experiences that I still question to this day. How could that have been true that happened? My wife tells me, you're the most psychic person I know. And meanwhile, I'm like walking around like, stop. I don't even like that word. So, like, you know, we have to relax into our multidimensional self. We have to understand that we are bigger than we allow ourselves to be. And so, I mean, that's right. And that's what lucid dreaming is about, is about taking off the orange sweater and wearing a different cloak.
Yeah. I think Wordsworth, I contain multitudes, right?
Yeah. Right. We do. We absolutely do. And of course we bring our dualisms into the dream as well. But even then they're tested. And playfully by the dream, and the guardians sometimes are simply our own inability to stay in the dream for long enough to get the message. And so sometimes, you know, what I say to folks is that, well, this is an invitation to practice more, to either develop a longer awareness set, to do more either concentrative practices or nature awareness settings. How can we support the inattentive mind in the dream? If that's a roadblock, like, oh, I get to have a meeting with somebody, but then it's just mumbles and then I fall out of the dream. And it's like, well, so the guardian there, the road is our own sort of like, oh, we're just not ready for this particular initiation. And I would say in a loose way that that's a failed initiation, but in the sense that we always have more encounters, we always have more abilities. It's just one more moment in time. So not to take it too seriously. There's got to be that playfulness with dreams. And if you lose the playfulness, I think all is lost.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that of course can be sometimes a consequence of the using the meditative maxim, not too tight, not too loose. You talk about beautifully in this book. And when I read that, it actually helped me, because sometimes you know, like I have to go into a lab. They're going to put all these expensive crap on me. I've got to produce a lucid dream. I mean, you don't think that's going to make me tight? And actually, this is one of the beautiful things about Stephen LaBerge in his trainings in Hawaii, right? I mean, they're incredibly relaxed environments. And so to me, this what you're talking about here is that if we're too tight, and I tend to fall into that camp, that's what makes this space very interesting. It doesn't abide by classic approaches. Yes, we need intentionality. Yes, we need conviction. some discipline. Otherwise, it's not a practice. But again, if we bring our daytime strategies into nocturnal worlds, some of that stuff has to be left behind because it doesn't really work. On one level, it's like, in fact, after I read that in your book, I said, wait, I'm trying too hard. I relaxed. Hey, guess what? That night, big lucid dream. And so say more, a little bit more about that. And also, as we started it at a kind of a ground level, we rocketed up to the high altitude approaches. Maybe we can come back down for our listeners and talk a little bit more about how to use the talisman, because you talked briefly, we didn't really circumambulate back or circle back to it, how to use it for state checks, how to continue to engage in it, in addition to some of the things we've already talked about, because I want to join heaven and earth here and leave people with like, what other ways can I use this? Because maybe now we've imbued it with a little bit of view and power of how deep this object, this little object can actually be.
Good.
It may be bring it back to earth and say, hey, we got this beautiful thing. A little bit more about other manners of engagement, employment, so to speak, and what more people can do with it.
Good. Yeah. So, I mean, so to this question about relaxation or working too hard, that was a big aha moment that I had when I had to produce a bunch of lucid dreams for writing my master's thesis. Because I was like, I'm going to do this really cool induction process. And to do so, I had, you know, set that I needed to have 10 lucid dreams within basically a quarter. And I was realizing I wasn't having enough lucid dreams very quickly. And I was remembering my protocol, and I was getting to get anxious, socially anxious. My advisors, you know, questioning me, where's your draft? All these kind of things are happening. And so what happened was winter break is what happened. And I relaxed all of my intentionality practices. I really just took time off. And I immediately began having lucid dream after lucid dream over winter break. And I thought it was ironic. I was like, this is so ironic. And then I thought about it more. I was like, no, this is something deeper. And so what came out of that was the way that I've been teaching lucid dreaming for the last 10 years or so, which is the immersion method, which is to immerse yourself in lucid dreaming and lucid living for a set amount of time with a strong boundary, and then to stop the practices and see what comes and just relax. And what I find is that mixing really works for creativity, and it really works for folks who, especially who are wound too tight, and their lucid dreams come when their time is off. Others come when they're really doing the practices. And I think that there's other things going on as well, as such as dream delay and other kinds of physiological things that are more about brain than it is. You know, I don't know, but all I know is that it works, and it's resonant with what we know about dream incubation societies around the world, right? You know, like the Asclepian tradition, the ancient Greek dream sanctuaries, in which folks were invited to a temple to dream, but only after they essentially had been on campus long enough where the priests were like, okay, now you can come in. And so they had to really relax and detox and eat only very limited diet, as well as just mixing up their sleep with prayer, lots of prayer. And then they were invited into the inner sanctuary to request a dream of Asclepian, to Asclepius, to have a, you know, a powerful healing dream. And so taking those elements and bringing them into modern life, like not all of us can always go and be on retreat. So how do you make that into waking life? And you do this by creating your own lucid sanctuary in confinement, and then letting things go and notice what happens, take the data, and then mix up your practices. Because we burn out otherwise. We just simply burn out. Lucid burnout is a major problem, I think, in lucid education. And people get very frustrated, and the frustration becomes another roadblock from success. And then it just spirals and spirals, and we lose folks. So relaxation is key. And so that's why I say for the talisman, you know, to take some time and put it away when you're not using it actively, and to let it recharge. And, you know, is the talisman recharging, or are you you know, recharging. Does it matter? It doesn't matter. The thing is that the practice is what matters. And then to bring it back when you're really ready for this time to, oh, I'm going to really be able to spend some time going to sleep mindfully. And I have enough energy that I can disturb my sleep in the middle of the night. And I'm ready for that. And I have time to write my dreams down either in the morning or soon after. Like, right. Because it takes, there's some, it's not just intentionality, right? We have to like make space for this in our lives to do these practices. So the talisman helps with that because it makes a ritual of, am I doing lucid practices or not? It helps us see, are we on or not? And then the reality check. The reality check is sort of the major way that the talisman was first conceived. It's just as it's a very convenient token to hold in your pocket. And every time you come in contact with it, you say, oh, am I dreaming? And then take a moment. How do you know you're not dreaming, right? What kind of reality check do you use? My personal one is holding my nose because I can breathe while I'm holding my nose if I'm dreaming, and I can't if I'm awake. And that particular one has not failed me, whereas most other ones have at some time or another. Or, you know, if you, it just depends on your own kind of mind. How is text in your dream? Is it very ephemeral? Because looking at the text of the talisman and flipping it over, taking a moment, putting your attention somewhere else, bringing it back, looking back, your working memory is still long enough engaged to know what it should say, right? Even in the dream, the working memory is still long enough to know what it used to say. And of course, for most, it changes. And so that's one of those things. It's got this kind of cool, bizarre, esoteric feel to it that allows that liminality of to come in. And then this was a surprise, is once we started working with the talisman, it began sort of manifesting itself spontaneously in the dream itself, which I did not necessarily know would happen. But once it did, I realized that the talisman itself works as a dream sign. And so if you're really spending some time looking at it every day, the talisman will show up in your dream. In one dream, I was in the dream, and then suddenly the talisman just comes into my consciousness on a string as if someone's bobbing it in front of me. And I'm like, what the heck is going on here? And then I realized I was dreaming because of that.
It's the hook of humanity. Yeah.
So that's the dream sign aspect of it, which is, I think, kind of secondary. But so really it is about noticing awareness and groundedness. And for me, you know, I am an anxious temperament. And so the talisman, I what happens, like I'm in line getting coffee and I put my hands in my pocket because I'm a little socially anxious. I come in contact with the talisman and I like, oh, and I let myself breathe and I ground and I ask myself if I'm dreaming. And I just sort of, right, I just kind of come down a notch and become more aware in a comfortable sense of my surroundings. And so it has a nice kind of effect in that way as well, of just as a grounding temperament, almost the way that AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, uses tokens as well. It's got this really nice way of grounding in the moment so we don't get lost in memory or desire. So those are some of the practices.
So this is really, really great stuff. Say a little bit more, because this is one of the questions I have for you, is how, say more about how it incepts into dreams. So, you know, the movie Inception, you talk about that in your book. This is a phrase or a wording that's may not be familiar to people, but you're intimating that. So how the talisman, say maybe a little bit more about how, outside of being a dream sign, other ways that it can incept into a dream.
Right. So there's a spontaneous nature as a liminal object that we've imbued with intentionality that will show up and eventually can become an anchor. It can become what we're doing is essentially we're anchoring our intentionality, our desire, our question to the coin itself. And so as a liminal object, that coin becomes what you could call an alchemical emblem. It becomes in itself a holograph of all of those all those intentionalities. And so when the coin is seen in the dream, it's like an imparting of information and intention that comes with it. And so it holds that all of it in this really cool, magical way that is beyond words, right? And so we often, you know, and maybe this is because of laboratory definitions, we say in lucid dreaming, you have to say or think, I know I'm dreaming. But of course, sometimes that doesn't really happen. We just have an inner knowing. And so sometimes the talisman does that. It shows up and there's this inner knowing. I'm in a magical place and I can go about, you know, living as a magical being now. And so it's almost like it's an invitation to being a different person, being a different selfhood.
Fantastic. And if we use the term carefully, reified intention, right? Reification is such a tricky term, right? Because it's, if there's an original sin in Buddhism, reification born of ignorance would be it, right? And the path to awakening is a path to wisdom or de-reification. But I think if we use the word reification properly, what I mean by this on a deeper level, one of the ways I work with lucid dreaming at a really elevated level is the more I quote unquote reify my dream, the more by immediate implication, I de-reify my waking state until I see the equanimous nature of both. And so I think that's very interesting. And I throw this into the mix is because we've used this term, you've used this term over and over, intentionality. And I want to just share with you, I did a dream yoga, a brief training with Tsogyen Rinpoche, who's an amazing master. And the only induction method he gave, the only induction method was intentionality. And I think this is really important because people think, yes, it's great. You and I, we're geeks. All the techniques, all the gadgets, the galantamine, the goggles, you name it, we got it. We've used it. I'm not dissing that at all. But on one level, you have a mind. You have intention. On one level, and Tsogyen Rinpoche just stamped it. He goes, that's all you need. And So in a really beautiful way, anchoring your intention, qualified term, reifying it into the talisman, all of a sudden it's like, hey, now this thing has a little bit more traction for me because I believe in the world of matter, whatever. But I just wanted to throw that out there because I think this is no small thing. On one level, the power of intentionality alone, literally to stretch towards, right? That quality of mind will stretch towards and into acting as intentionality in itself acts as that liminal psychic motivator, that bridge from the
waking. It's a bridge. Yes, that's it. That's it. It's a bridge, right? When you look at phenomenology, which is where my training is in, intentionality isn't just a desire or a prospective memory of a task. It's a relationship. It's the moving forward of into the world. It's the tether that we interact with all that is not available to my inner awareness. And so intentionality, once we harness it and understand it and know what we want, and that's tough. That's a tough one. And so I teach intentionality first too. I spend a lot of time with folks to why do you want to lucid dream rather than you want to have a lucid dream? Well, why? What are you trying? What is the draw? What is the picture of being lucid that is pushing you forward? And there's no right answer here because folks have different motivations. And like I say, sometimes my framework now is some folks kind of move towards these upper world intentionalities that have to do more about abstraction and mindfulness and transcendence. And others have intentionalities that are more of the lower world that are about transforming emotionality into psycho-spiritual powers, you know, a path of transformation. And so even just knowing in a super easy sense, am I kind of moving towards upper world intentions or lower world intentions, that can be really helpful in motivation. And we all have just our own kind of, you know, essence or tether to the dream where we gravitate. And so we can really look at our past dreams, and non-lucid dreams included, my gosh, really look at the non-lucid dreams and see, you know, how do I move in a dream and who am I and what moves me? right? What's that? That's the question. What moves me? Because once we're on board, the dream is on board with us.
Yeah, boy, just to ramp this up just a tiny bit more is when you bring this power of intentionality and movement, now you're talking about karma. I mean, that's what karma is. Karma, literally Tibetan lay, literally means to act, to move. What is it that creates karma, even in a dream? And this is the great gift, you know, both the warning and the great gift of lucidity and dream yoga practices. Whenever intention is involved, even in a dream, karma is created, right? And so that's either good or bad news, depending on how you relate to that intentionality. So once again, to empower, that's kind of the theme for today, to empower the power of intentionality, this is a fundamental. I mean, basically, intention is almost synonymous with karma. Mm-hmm. So whether it's mental, physical, verbal, a little bit more reified as you get into the physical, intention is that which moves us. And so in this case, we're moving from the waking state into the dreaming state, bringing this lucidity or awareness with us. So this is, again, it's like, whoa, this stuff is, you know, this is fractal. Like, there's a lot of depth here, right? So
yeah. Yeah. And it's something that, you know, the early lucid dreaming researchers were really looking at. If you look at Patricia Garfield's early work, she used an intention-based, you know, model that allowed her to move into those lucid spaces. And I'm talking, this is like her book, The Way of the Dream Mandala. You know, it was written in the 70s. If you look at Stefan Williams, the book of Sonoy Dreamwork Handbook, he's talking about intentionality in a way that's about choice. And then I think what happened through the scientific process of lucidity being reified or being verified is that the model became cognitive only, and we sort of lost some of these powers, these very ancient powers, and they're still there. We haven't lost them. We just have to remember them. And so it's just what it really is about in a big way, is just these old powers are present. And not only that, but we're just neurobiologically or neuroshamanically aligned with them. They're just right there. So it's easy to move with them, right? And it's easy. And that's why some liminal objects work and some don't. You know, it's why plastic, I don't make, you know, the talisman is not made of plastic for a reason.
Yeah, you know, the Buddhist tradition often mentioned earlier, often talks about meteoric iron as being that which really carries the greatest kind of elemental impact, right? That's also really interesting. The other thing that came to mind, this is really amazing. We haven't really lost the old powers. We've just forgotten them. This is an astounding statement. The Rajarijan once said, and this is a seminal statement for me, is the essence of spiritual practice is remembrance. Mm. Remembering, rejoining, recollecting. I mean, it's so foundational. The word in Tibetan for mindfulness meditation, drenpa, means to remember, to recollect. So this stuff is like, whoa, talk about different levels of applicability and depth here. So these practices really are designed on one level to jog our memory, to wake us up to these latent powers that basically, if we make ourselves more available to them, largely by what? Believing in them, right? Realizing that they are available. They're right here, right now. We just have to open to them using magic transitional object. That's the other thing this is. This is like a transitional object in the Winnicottian way, relating to...
That's right.
Another way to talk about that, using it as a transitional object from one state of...
And people will say, well, this is just a placebo. And I'm like, that's right. Let us harness the endogenous healing response. Let us harness this. It doesn't matter if we believe it or not, it works. We allow room for it to work.
And the placebo effect, nocebo effect, I mean, what is that? That's a belief effect. It's a mind effect. And so then that, again, comes back into play, you know, just empowering the power of our own minds. So God, there's so much to say this. I'm so jazzed here. A couple more things here that I really want you to riff on. and maybe we'll have to do this again, right? There's so much here. This is like a short little book. And I said, I hope we have enough to talk about. It's like, we can just start a series here. Talk to us a little bit about what you come on in the latter part of the book about these talismans, this apotropaic amulets. I was like, whoa, what is that? That's a big ass term. So atrotropaic amulets. This is actually ties a little bit to what we talked about at the earlier part of the conversation. And again, another way to use these things. We're using them in so many. This is a, you know, it's a multivalent object, right? There's so many different ways we can use it, just like the dream itself. So here's another dimension, using this to work with protection and fear.
Yeah, so apotropaia is to move against fear. And so apotropaic objects, and it stumbles on my mouth, but it means objects that are imbued to protect. And so this, in the archaeological context, is what when we were speaking earlier about, say, crosses and, you know, horse skulls buried under the house, they protect and they help people basically have a realm of psychic protection against malevolent forces. This is how they're used. And we see them in archaeological contexts all over the world. They're often placed in places of liminality, in between zones of activity, in between zones of being, inside, outside, right? Up and, you know, there's always some kind of spatial liminality to them. A talisman works in this way to protect against nightmares. And that's what amulets have been used for, you know, this is probably their number one use around the world today in all kinds of religious contexts. And people, of course, will carry, you know, the object on them, or they'll sleep with it next to them, or they'll sleep with it under their pillow to prevent nightmares. And it is a talisman in that sense. And so I stumbled upon some really cool Kabbalistic talismans that were used in the 19th century. They're Aramaic, that they talk about how they are consecrated by the rabbi, and essentially they're these wonderful plates that were inscribed with prayer. And essentially, prayers of banishment against certain kinds of "quote unquote" demons, and they were, and we also see this with Lilin demons in earlier eras, you know, the demons of Lilith, and these were known as entities that came to harass sleepers at night, or when they are sleeping alone, or. So they can come during the day, during naps, and they can come at night, and they oppress dreamers. They sit on their chest. They sexually molest them. They steal their energy, right? And so all what we would call today the complex of sleep paralysis and hypnagogic visions is what these things were warding off of. And they are made of, and then we see amulets made of silver that use this. We see these Aramaic 13th, 15th century plates. It's wonderful. All of these different traditions that use this process. And so the talisman can be used in that sense too, if one has a fear that needs some grounding in. And again, does it work? Is it a placebo? It doesn't really matter. It's about creating ritual. It's about creating feelings of safety and protection and using prayer in psychic self-defense actively. And I think this is important because as Western dreamers, we have our day world consciousness and we don't believe in ghosts. And then we go to sleep and we have an experience where something slightly unusual happens and we freak out, because it doesn't fit the paradigm, and we move into fear immediately because we're using the wrong paradigm. In the dream world, spirits exist, entities exist, otherworldly creatures exist. So we need to be able to work with them, protect ourselves if need be, and, you know, essentially build beneficial relationships. And that's something that I just love to bring up, because it doesn't matter if you don't believe it in waking life. If you're losing sleep at night because of sleep paralysis, that's a sign that there's a misjointed paradigm.
This is, my gosh, I meant so much to talk about here. I mean, one just a couple of things. One is that we've been talking a little bit about the developmental thing and using colors, which some people here may not be familiar with. This is a classical, Claire Graves, Carl Beck and others, a way to talk about development using particular color things. And so just to say one brief thing here, and again, seed for a whole another conversation, is that in a very real way, and I hadn't thought about this before, during the waking state, we're principally, again, first tier, we're basically dealing with developmental levels that we embody during our waking reality. And that perhaps, open question, when we enter the dream arena where the veils are thinner, perhaps to greater or lesser degrees, we're invited in lucidity then the conscious relationship to this jump into the second tier. And so maybe this is part of what could actually be happening in a developmental way that I actually haven't really thought of before. So that's another gift from you today. But here's something interesting that came to mind, Ryan, is that in the Tibetan tradition and others as well, and I do this every day in my 3-year retreat, we did an hour and 20 minutes of this every single day. We do incredibly elaborate ritual protector practices. In fact, in my retreat, sadhanas that last an hour and 20 minutes every night at dusk, which is a liminal dimension. You're going from the waking space. That's when people often notice different, like, hey, I'm a little bit unsettled psychically, whatever. I know a lot of people start their evening cocktails then as a way to work with that. But it's very interesting that the protector principle is another way to, as a multivalent object, that we can work with the talisman. And at a very deep level, I also not only can it protect against nightmares, but I think the talisman at a deeper level can protect against nightmare principle, which again is what? The fundamental nightmare is reification. Yes, the mantra is scary, the monster is scary, but it's only scary if you take it to be real. It's a primordial mistake. And so on a kind of more entry level isn't the right word, but I'll use it. The talisman can work at that level, but you can put it in your pocket, imbue it with this mnemonic as kind of an aid to remember. That's a spiritual practice is remembrance, that every time you relate to it, touch it, it can protect you against reification by basically being, say, every time you touch it, recite, this is a dream. And so this ties in then to the practice of illusory form.
Yeah.
So that's another fantastic thing. You touch it, ultimate nightmare is nightmare principle, reification. You hold on to it, mnemonic, every time I touch this thing, prospective memory comes in, right? I'm going to remember to say, every time I see it, touch it, this is a dream. And so there you're really protecting against nightmares because you're protecting against reification. So it's like, dude, in this last hour and a half, you've completely imbued my relationship to this in a way that it's like this whole thing is somewhat metaphoric of my new
good. Relationship. That means you can now put it on your shelf.
Yeah, exactly. Or make it more available to my audience, right? Because this is my new number 3 magic induction method. So I'm wondering if you have any questions or I should say comments about that. And then as we start to wrap up, because I want to be sensitive to your time, I wanted to say a little bit more about what you talk about in the book. We talked about how to activate it. And then to a certain extent, you've already said this, but maybe as we're starting to close up, just to reinstate, or if there's anything additional you want to say, how to keep it active. So we've been peppering this, but maybe are there other things about, again, I want to leave people with, whoa, I had no idea I could use this in so many wonderful, magical ways. So any other things come to mind along those lines?
Yeah, so I spoke about how you can put the talisman away when you're not using it actively, or you could just, you know, I have one of my talismans that I actually do use as a book weight. It holds the pages down as I'm reading the opposite page, and that was not activated, right? And so, and I don't use it actively. I use it as a book weight. What you don't want to do is mix those two worlds. and essentially have a desacralized relationship during the day with a talisman and then expect it to have powers when you put it under your pillow at night. And so it's about respecting, yeah, the category of use for the coin. And what happens, and this is true for me, and I've heard from many other people, is of course that, you know, there's an excitement at first about using it. Andrew, your experience of having a lucid dream sort of the first night is not unusual. People have a lot of excitement at first, and there's just this a lot of power to that. And then what tends to happen is that people, you know, lose that excitement and maybe stop doing the practices, and then it doesn't work anymore. And so I just say, well, look, this is the time to put it away. And so notice that. Notice when that's happening and tie it back to your practices. If we try to lucid dream all of the time, we can get burned out. It doesn't mean that we can't be 24/7 trying to become more lucid people, or that mindfulness can only be done in spits and spats. That's not what it means. But these induction practices especially can be something that if it becomes cognitively domesticated just like anything else. I'll put it that way. Yeah. We just cognitively domesticate ourselves and it can become a routine. And so protect against that about using it seasonally. And maybe, you know, this thing you're saying about liminality as approaching time, right? So dusk and spirits. but also what about, you know, the calendar, like the liminal zones of the calendar, you know, looking at, you know, we've got the eight quarter days every 6 weeks. These are the moments between time from a pagan perspective, where energies are high, where the boundaries reduce, where the veil is thin. And so like they really, the talisman can be incorporated into rituals like that as well, where you can charge the talisman with a full moon, for instance, right? And you can charge a talisman at the summer solstice, put it out on your table with your other objects. And if you have stones or other kinds of dream catchers that you use, collect them, recharge them, you know, because we're doing prayer at that time, or we're doing practices or remembrance, which is, I think, a big meta theme of today's talk. Remembering the old ways, but remembering our connection to these deeper ways of being and that we can access them. So, yeah, so the liminality works around in that way, too.
Beautiful. And speak briefly about the other iterations of it. It comes as an amulet. You have other ways, right? My understanding.
Right. So the way I've been using the terminology is that the coin I call the talisman, and then the necklace version I call an amulet or a pendant, depending on, because there's a couple of different designs. One of the designs is more esoteric than the other. You know, the relic has got this sort of, some people think it's creepy. I don't think it's creepy, but it's got the cosmic tree and the moon and the eye on it. It's got a more of a Celtic vibe. So some people are attracted to this one more than the classic talisman. But the sense is that if you've got it on your person like this, it works like an amulet, but it's also a conversation piece, right? And so someone would be like, oh, that's a cool necklace. Like, oh yeah, this is how I remember that I'm lucid dreaming. What's lucid dreaming? Oh, so, right. And then you can just, and this is anytime, of course, we talk about dreams, we're creating more connections, more tethers to that other world, and we're waking up the world along with us.
That's really great. And so, oh my gosh, with that in mind, before I forget, we are going to post a link to how people can order this from you. Is there anything you want to say about that in terms of accessibility, availability for these talismans?
So the site is lucidtalisman.com, and you can buy my book there as well. And you can buy the book with a talisman. If you buy them together, you save some money, basically, because the way that they bundle together. And so I encourage people to buy the book with the talisman. If you buy the book, you can buy the book and not buy a talisman, and then you can just use your own liminal object, right? And so you could use your own cross or your own special token and do these practices as well. And so it's not, the book is geared towards the Taoism, but it's also open enough that it's really for anyone to just kind of re-stoke that passion for liminal objects in general. Yeah, so yeah, everything is available there at lucidtaoism.com.
And then, is there any question that you wish I would have asked? Any topic that we haven't covered that's specifically related? I mean, there's so many tangential topics that are so interesting. But any other particular last words around the talisman that you might want to share with us?
You know, I can't think of anything right now. And I feel like this conversation was really balanced. You know, often people see my work or are interested in my work with lucid nightmares because of the research that I've done in that area. And it's nice to be able to talk about the positivity and the expansiveness about lucid dreaming. So I appreciate how balanced this conversation has been in that regard.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And as we start to wrap it up, what's your current passion? What are you currently researching or working on? How can my audience interrelate with you and support what you're doing? Tell us a little bit about what you're up to now.
Yeah, so the talisman's kind of like a side hustle, but what I'm really up to these days is teaching, and I'm getting back into teaching about dreams. I teach on the graduate level for a couple of universities, you know, in an adjunct style. But I also have kind of ramped up my own online academy, Dream Studies Academy, which I started, I think, in 2015 was the first time that I started teaching classes on lucid dreaming. And so I've been teaching lucid dreaming, and I've been teaching this new class on the archetypes of lucid dreaming that talks about, really moves into detail about some of the things we've been talking here today about lower world intentions and upper world intentions, as well as solar and lunar consciousness, because archetypes form from sort of when you put those two systems together. And so I've really been geeking out with a class on what are these lucid archetypes and how can we get to know these different, you know, egoic garbs, as I say, that, and what is the possibilities access there. So my website is dreamstudies.org, and that's where I have my blog, my research blog, and you know, I have a free ebook there as well called Enhance Your Dream Life that folks can download to get a taste for some, like, really some elementary, I call it Dream Studies 101.
Brian, this has just been so rich. I can't tell you, really. From this tiny little book that I said, it, like, completely drew me in. To the depth and the scope of this conversation has been a delightful way to be reintroduced to your work and your contributions to this world. And so on behalf of my community, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang with us. I, for one, have learned a heck of a lot. So big bow of gratitude, and let's do it again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a blast.
Take care, my friend.